Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Hi, thanks for being here. I've been talking quite a bit lately, relatable to the last few Go shows, about the mind and body, unity, separation, so on and so forth. The last Go show we read was a letter that Nichiren surmised some of the aspects of the last seven chapters of the Lotus Sutra in discussing with an elderly lay nun. It dawned on me as I prepared for today's talk that I just wanted to remind that the second 14 chapters of the Lotus Sutra are known as the essential chapters. Sometimes the sutra is divided, as I spoke at length of in my lecture series, the Lotus Lectures, and you can find that playlist and go chapter by chapter there. That sometimes the Lotus Sutra is subsectioned into thirds, roughly. This is an aspect of Buddhist scholarship that is constantly being looked at for thousands of years, dissecting, you know, what is a foundational thought of Shakyamuni Buddha's sermons versus a more in-depth or developing thought and a culminating thought. The five periods are determined this way, the sutras themselves this way. And in a very simplistic way, I think it becomes obvious to us with our modern capacities and minds that the first sermon, when he first attained his own enlightenment, his Buddha, Shakyamuni or Siddhartha Gautama, at the time when he achieved his Buddhahood, was given the moniker of the saint, the great saint from the Shakya clan, Shakyamuni. He tried to explain to his followers at that time what attaining enlightenment was like. And everyone was fascinated, but so you attain this Buddha and this is what it felt like, this is how you experienced it, but just knowing how you experienced it doesn't really help us. What do we do with that? I have no idea how you got to that. There was a lot of confusion. So he backed off very quickly and realized in his Buddhahood that, oh yeah, I have to raise your capacity to understand what I'm talking about step by step, just like I had to go through 6 or 7 years of all sorts of investigation to finally come to this realization, this enlightenment. So he started on this program of teaching how to get to this epiphany. So I'm saying all of this for two reasons. Number one, to understand that the scholarship of Buddhism, even though we talk about lesser vehicles, provisional vehicles, essential vehicles, that kind of thing, I don't want to minimize Hinayana or Theravada or Tripitaka or, you know, any of those groupings of teachings, legitimate teachings, not errant teachings. Those are poppycock. Those are distraction. They actually become obstacles. Like reincarnation, how that crept into the lineage of Buddhism for a while and to this day in particular forms, you know the ones. That's just utter, it's worse than silliness. It's counterproductive. It's counter your awakening, Buddhism. So in the parlance of Nichiren, it's an enemy of Buddha, right? Because it distracts you from the path. But it had its place. It was a door to enter so that once you got into the next room or hallway, you could build on your understanding and get the next step. Just like my math analogy. If you learn geometry, that doesn't mean that adding and subtraction are meaningless anymore. They're very meaningful, but they're not meaningful as an ultimate step. They're a building block so that geometry makes sense, trigonometry makes sense, so on and so forth, right? But none of them can accomplish what advanced mathematics can accomplish, right? That's just an obvious, I feel like I need to remind from some comments that I've heard that just because those earlier teachings don't contain the aha moment, the tool for realization immediately of Buddha, doesn't mean that they're not valuable. They are contained within the teaching of the Lotus Sutra. But now the Lotus Sutra is interesting because expedient means, and all throughout Buddha's teachings, he was dealing with getting people to understand this idea of how the body and the mind work together and don't work together. In other words, or maybe more accurately, the way the mind can be counterproductive and can actually establish physical obstacles. The mind penetrates the body and the body becomes sicker or healthier depending on the condition of the mind. Equally, if you abuse the body, you can create obstacle for the mind because the mind is full of attachments, the human mind. And I distinguish it as human because the Buddha mind, or what we call the Buddha mind, or the Buddha-ness, is a cognizant knowing of mind that transcends further the operational aspects of the physical consciousness mind of samsara. So Buddhism and Buddhist teachings constantly walk this line with examples, mental exercises to develop the practitioner's understanding of the mind's separateness while being in existence through the mechanization of body, which is not just this, but the world around this. This is why there's no separation in Buddhism between self and environment, right? So if you can grasp that idea, then you can see that in the Lotus Sutra, the latter chapters, after the lifespan chapter, where Shakyamuni makes it critically obvious that his Buddhahood is not his, that he, as a normal human man, was able to cognate and perceive differently his entire experience of life from a Buddha perspective rather than a body perspective. In other words, no longer attached samsara as a consciousness, but a consciousness far more profound that is detached, not annihilating those things, but seeing them for what they are. A perspective unique to that detached observational understanding, observation of life itself and its various formations could only be reached through humanhood, if you will. And so conversely, in the after the lifespan chapter, when he said this Buddha nature, this Buddhahood, isn't attached to a body. It's rather, it's a part of the experience, not even the environment, because that's body as well, but the experience, the energy of all of it. But your perceptive tools, in other words, eye consciousness, oral consciousness, taste, touch, feel, all of that, are samsaric. Their body, but those samsaric body manifestations are manifest of this desire for life, to experience that life force, to witness it, requires all of this apparatus. And yet all of this apparatus does not prove it or deny it. It's simply experienced. Another analogy comes to mind. I don't know if it'll work, but you know, there's occasionally these spurts of documentaries and programs that come on that we have access to about the Mariana Trench and under the ocean, the very deep ocean that's so black, no light, no sunlight gets down there. There's no photosynthesis happening to make life as we know it on the surface of the planet. And yet, way down in that darkness, underneath many atmospheres of pressure, certain kinds of species of things, funguses, other things, fish, live without eyes, with other ways of existing. Now, did that just start happening because we looked there? It's like the quantum thing, right? If you measure it, is it there because you measure it? If you don't measure it, is it not there? So if we develop scientifically diving bells and submarines and pressure tools and so forth to take us down to the depth of that ocean crevasse and discover things, is it because we created all of those things that we can experience that crevasse? That crevasse and the life in it was there all along. It's simply that we had to build the tools to be able to dive that deeply and survive, that we could experience what was going on in the depth of that crevasse. So think of Buddha this way, that crevasse has been there all along. It's just that we had to build our understanding of our relationship with the environments, with ourselves, right? In order to finally get beyond our limitations and see our Buddha, experience our Buddha, which is what we do when we chant to this mandala of Gohonzon. We directly request and invoke, request internally, of our experience on earth, our Buddha perception. And the more we understand how that mind-body relationship works, the more we understand how letting that body not preoccupy our invocation of Buddha, the closer we get to hanging on to that Buddha perspective. But even without all knowing all that complexity, it's there. Your Buddha is there. So this previous Gosho, when Nichiren is talking to this elderly woman who's feeling uncertain and has doubts, he goes through those seven chapters, and basically what he explains to her is that through your bodily experience of losing son, losing husband, so on and so forth, your grief, there's a difference between your physical grief and your mental grief. And there are the benefits that one gets from chanting, from practicing Lotus Sutra Buddhism, is these mental illusions getting pushed out of the way and enabling, opening a window of fresh air, if you will, of Buddha, and how certain that is a reward of your practice, how certain the outcome is to be an awakening rather than staying mired in that mental suffering. So to put it another way, the last chapters of the Lotus Sutra are about, again, what experiencing your Buddha will bequeath you, will reward you, the experience that you will shed, change, and re-perceive, the liberation that you will incur, that you will accrue from your practice. It is certain, it is guaranteed. So this is why the Lotus Sutra, if you analyze it, you study and you read it correctly, is basically a document of practice. Here's your goal, here's what it looks like, here's what it sounds like, here's what you get from it. It, what is it? Well, it is the sutra, Myoho Renge Kyo. It bothers some that that's not explicitly said, but I would argue that it is explicitly said. If you take it into context of the entirety of the teachings, it becomes obvious then that the Lotus Sutra, the wonderful Dharma flower, is the practice. So now we're going to read a letter he wrote to Shijo Kingo. Nichiren had been sick for several days. He's having diarrhea. He's having all kinds of problems, very bodily. As you know by now, Shijo Kingo was somewhat of a doctor, a medical, somebody who understood medicines, herbs, and so forth. And so he had sent Nichiren some medications, and Nichiren was improving. So obviously this is going to be a letter of thanks, but he's also going to delve into Buddhist concepts and take the opportunity to speak a little more on this duality of samsara, body, mind. And so the letter is titled, Two Kinds of Illness. And it begins, the illnesses of human beings may be divided into two general categories, the first of which is illness of the body. Physical diseases comprise 101 disorders of the earth element, 101 of the water element, 101 of the fire element, and 101 of the wind element, for a total of 404 maladies. Now this is, again, he's borrowing from historical teachings. In fact, let me go ahead and read that. Earth, water, fire, and wind were regarded by ancient Indians as they constituent elements of all things. In terms of the human body, earth corresponds to flesh, bone, skin, and hair, water to blood and sweat, fire to body temperature, and wind to the function of breathing. The number 101 indicates not an exact number of illnesses, but rather simply a great many. So, beyond that, these illnesses can be cured with the medicines prescribed by skilled physicians, such as water holder, water carrier, jivaka, and pian chue. So these are historical figures who understood these elements, right? The second category is illness of the mind. These are the three poisons and the 84,000 illnesses. 84,000, wow. 84,000 illnesses here simply means a great many, again. Hereafter, these are referred to as either 84,000 or 80,000 illnesses. These illnesses arise from the three poisons inherent in human life. Only a Buddha can cure them. Does that mean a little fat guy comes right? By the way, the Buddha was never fat. But is the visual a little Buddha runs up and touches your head and heals you? Because that's magical thinking. That's not what we're talking about here. A Buddha is your realization of Buddha. Your perspective, your shifted mind, your awakened enlightenment. That's what takes care of mental illness. And I'll repeat myself again. Buddhism is about the mind. So when we talk about a Buddha curing them. We're talking about a mental condition. Thus, they are beyond the healing powers of the two deities and the three ascetics, not to mention those of Shen Nung and Huang Ti. And I'll let you look those up. Those are more expedient means stories. Illnesses of the mind differ greatly in severity. These three poisons and the 84,000 illnesses that afflict ordinary people of the six paths can be treated by the Buddha of the Dharma Analysis Treasury. So what he's saying there is by the time the Dharma Analysis Treasury was taught as an expedient means, the capacity of the people's minds were such that they could control these illnesses, that they could affect those illnesses. They wouldn't just snap their fingers and be better. They would, with focused intent, ameliorate. Just like when a loved one dies and you enter into a depression and you're maudlin' and you can't eat and you can't sleep and that's an illness of the mind. And over time, your mind starts to heal itself. You start to see a life in a broader sense. You carry with you the memories. Everyone has a different process, but it's a mental process. You know, we say time heals all wounds. Well, it's not the time that heals the wounds. It's the mind that heals the mind. It's a process. It's a process of letting go and appreciation. It's a process of love and loss. It's a process of development from moment to moment. And with a Gohonzon, if we can awaken our Gohonzon, our Buddha wisdom, we can transgress that grieving time to much more constructive and loving and living experience much more quickly, and even offer through our own karma a filial, if it's a family member or a relative, some kind of a beneficial closing to our experience of their life. This is what the ceremony for the deceased is all about. And you immediately start healing. Establishment of truth and precept schools, which derive from the Tripitaka teachings of Hinayana. However, if one tries to use the Hinayana teachings to cure the three poisons and 80,000 illnesses that arise from slandering the Mahayana sutras, such as the Flower Garland, Wisdom, and Mahavatarchana sutras, these illnesses will merely become worse and never be cured. So what does that mean? It means if you study more advanced teachings, your capacity, therefore, is increased. Then whatever mental tools you gained from the earlier teachings will not be able, in fact, you'll aggravate the situation if you're actually practicing something of higher capacity, right? It only makes sense. They can be treated only with the Mahayana teachings. Moreover, if one attempts to use the Flower Garland, Wisdom, and Mahavatarchana Sutras, or the teachings of the True Word and the Three Treatises schools to cure the three poisons and 80,000 illnesses that arise when the practitioners of the various Mahayana sutras oppose the Lotus Sutra, those sicknesses will become all the more serious. To illustrate, the flames emitted by burning wood or coal can easily be extinguished by water. But if one pours water over fire produced by burning oil, it will only burn more intensely, the flames mounting still higher. Have you ever sprinkled a little cold water onto, or just water from the tap, onto some very hot oil that you're about to deep fry something into? It spits and spatters, right? It'll probably get oil on you. The water won't extinguish flames in oil. The epidemics that have been raging in Japan since the last year cannot be categorized within the 404 illnesses of the body. Thus, they belong to the healing powers of Huato and Bian Chu, nor do they correspond to any of the 84,000 diseases that can be treated with the Hinayana or provisional Mahayana teachings. For this reason, the prayers offered by, or the meditations offered by the monks of these schools based on those teachings not only fail to end the epidemics, but rather aggravate them all the more. Even if the epidemics should subside this year, they will surely break out again in years to come. Probably, they will come to an end only after something dreadful has happened. The Lotus Sutra says, quote, though he might practice the art of medicine and by its methods cure someone's disease, the person would grow sicker from some other malady and perhaps in the end would die. It would only make his condition worse. End quote. The Nirvana Sutra states, quote, at that time, King Ajatasattu of Rajagriha, boils broke out all over his entire body. The king said to his mother, these boils have their origin in the mind. They do not arise from the four elements. Though people say that there is a physician who can cure them, that could not possibly be. End quote. Miao Lo said, quote, wise men can perceive the cause of things as snakes know the way of snakes. The present epidemics are like the virulent boils of King Ajatasattu that could not be cured by anyone but the Buddha. They can only be eliminated by the Lotus Sutra. And by that, he means by the actual invocation and awakening of Buddha. And in fact, if you go back and read the story on King Ajatasattu, you will find that once he took resolve in the Lotus Sutra, his boils not only went away, but he lived 40 years beyond that event. So this basically Nichiren is restating this same teaching, quoting various sutras or parts of the sutra, right? I developed diarrhea, this is Nichiren talking, on the 13th day of the 12th month of last year, and up until the 3rd or 4th day of the 6th month of this year, it grew more frequent by the day and more severe by the month. Just when I was thinking that it must be my immutable karma, you sent me good medicine. Since taking it, my complaint has diminished steadily and is now a mere 100th fraction of its former intensity. I wonder if Shakyamuni Buddha has taken possession of your body to help me, or perhaps the bodhisattvas of the earth have bestowed upon me the good medicine of Myoho Renge Kyo. Chikugo Obo will explain all of this to you in more detail. So evidently Nichiren had a pretty bad case of dysentery. They didn't know what dysentery was back then, but they sure knew what they were experiencing. And Shijo Kingo was obviously experienced enough with medications that he knew what to give Nichiren to ameliorate him. But what Nichiren is drawing here is the idea that he received that help through this earthly means, through the mundane world. And because he and Shijo Kingo both practiced Lotus Sutra Buddhism, invoking their Buddha nature, there was an unseen communication through many, many, many miles, through messengers, that Nichiren was his trouble, and Shijo Kingo was able to determine what he needed. And all of this happens, you can start questioning time and all that, and I keep referring to this timelessness in Buddha, in Buddha-ness. And so there's this unsaid communication where Nichiren reaps the benefit of the teachings through mental connection with other humans to heal his body. But there's also an interesting thing that I think is easily glossed over here is Nichiren once again being a fallible human being. He's not a Buddha, because Buddha, a mind-life condition, doesn't get sick. But Nichiren, the human man, does. That sickness can threaten the mind. Right? Because if the body goes, so does the mind. But if you strengthen the mind, it can positively affect the body. And what Nichiren is saying here is it can actually extend its influence into its environment. In this case, Tokijonin and Shijokingo and their response to his physical ailment. Everything does this in Buddhism. There's a connectivity always. Nothing exists in and of itself. Oh my goodness, is he talking about impermanence again? Yes. All of this rolled into these conversations. So I think we have time to close this letter. Yeah, so he's done here. Postscript. Your messenger arrived at the hour of the dog on the 25th day of this month. The things you have sent me are beyond counting. Please convey my appreciation to Toki for his offering of a summer robe. Also, please tell your wife how saddened I am at the passing of her grandfather. With my deep respect, Nichiren. So, interesting little brief letter. Oh, wow. I haven't read this one in a while, but this is going to be good. Another short one coming up next, the one essential phrase. Bet you can't guess which it is. All right. So until we get together to review that, I wish you the best of help. No dysentery. Just Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. Keep chanting. Keep your practice strong. We are living in very strange times. I don't want to go into a whole political rant here, but my goodness, just look around. Just some of the most illogical, unbelievably ignorant statements being upheld as they're not, you know, to say they're upheld as truths, it's more true to say they're being upheld as alternate facts, whatever the hell that is. But, you know, when people are that desperate to claim identity with these strange mimetics and repetitions of things that, and waving flags, that they look like they believe in something, but really the only thing they truly believe in is utter chaos. And there's nothing more dangerous than a desperate human. And in that chaos, the most violent things can happen. So please be aware that our world is in a great state of confusion right now, and it could very easily get much, much worse. It may do so. I continuously chant that it doesn't, that somehow something shakes loose and people come to their senses. With your Daimoku and our concerted effort on awakening ourselves and as an example in our society, which I know is tough, but this is why we need to stick together very strongly, because we're going to be confronted face to face with people who seek us out just to create obstacles for us. They won't even know why, but we'll know why. And we need to be forbearing. We need to be gracious. And like Mr. Miyagi said in The Karate Kid, I think is the name of that old movie, best way to avoid confrontation, no be there. So chant for the wisdom to avoid those situations. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. I love all of you. I'm so proud of your practice. Please keep going. And we'll have fun with the next one. It should be really interesting. The one essential phrase. See you then. Bye-bye.